Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
Hey everyone, welcome to the second part in our series, Rendezvous with Death, where we're looking at Americans who went to volunteer to fight in World War I, years before America set the expeditionary force and formally entered the war. In the previous episode, we were talking about the political events that set the stage for America's involvement in World War I, and it had to do with a more robust foreign policy, where America fights Spain in the Spanish-American War, it takes control of islands in the Caribbean, Cuba. America also looks to impose its vision of its more assertive international policy of the Western Hemisphere on Asia. So the Spanish-American War signals a turn towards a more robust international role for the United States, with implications for the new century that's about to come. Now let's look at our next person that we're going to spend considerable time with in this series, and that is Bob Scanlon. For Bob Scanlon, the New South looked a lot like the Old South. He grew up African-American in the South in the 1890s, and being black in the 1890s and early 1900s made one an object of both derision and suspicion. If you were male, then the threat of violence was never far from the surface. It was during this period that lynching reached epidemic proportions in the South, with nearly 2,000 African Americans dying in this manner. Bob Scanlon of Mobile, Alabama, had limited options. The one thing he did have going for him was an athletic physique. The first decade of the 20th century witnessed the rise of the first black sports hero in America, the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, Jack Johnson. Johnson's rise to the top of the ranks of boxers generated fear and anger in many whites. For blacks, such as young Bob Scanlon, Johnson represented hope and racial pride. So it was no surprise that Scanlon himself used boxing to change his destiny. He followed in Johnson's historical wake and eventually found himself in what was for him a new world, and that was Europe. Between 1907 and 1910, Bob Scanlon fought 13 bouts in the United Kingdom and France, primarily as a light heavyweight, but also as a welterweight. London and Paris were a revelation to the young American. The venues for his fights were in some of the most notorious enclaves of the two cities, primarily London's Whitechapel district and the village of Montmartre in Paris. The Moulin Rouge, the Hippodrome, and the Montmartre drew the paying crowds to see the cards Scanlon boxed on in Paris. But there was much more going on in Montmartre than merely boxing. The site of Scanlon's first bout, the Moulin Rouge, with its eponymous windmill decorated with the bright red lights, had become an icon of the Paris demi-monde, literally the half-world, a term coined in the 19th century to describe the less reputable side of society inhabited by actors, gamblers, courtesans, artists, and addicts. Artist Henri Toulouse-Lautrec had immortalized a number of the cabaret's top performers in mass-produced promotional posters in the years before his death in 1901. High-kicking, red-headed can-can dancer Jane Avril and Black Love nightclub singer Yvette Goubert drew both starving artists and wealthy aristocrats in the Moulin Rouge, the Chat Noir, the Black Cat, and the Lapine Agile, the Agile Rabbit. The latter was favored by Pablo Picasso, who had arrived in Paris from Barcelona in 1900, and like so many other artists, had been drawn to Montmartre for its cheap rents and unapologetically bohemian lifestyle. Sex drove most of the cabaret's business, or rather sex mixed with art, alcohol, and drugs. Of these, the most fashionable and the most dangerous was absinthe. First developed in the 18th century, the green-colored liqueur was incredibly potent with a distinctive taste as a result of the anise and wormwood used in its production. Pernod was the preferred brand of connoisseurs, though many labels competed for the French market. The addictive, deleterious, and hallucinogenic effects of absinthe made it an object of criticism from social conservatives who feared it would corrode the health and morals of French society. But the socio-political divide between right and left in France extended beyond the bottle. It had its roots, arguably, as far back as the French Revolution. One party believed they represented tradition against radicalism, the other was sure they represented progress and the future in the face of reaction. In the years prior to Bob Scanlon's debut as a professional fighter at the Moulin Rouge, France had nearly torn itself apart over the conviction of a captain of artillery on charges of espionage. The tremendous strides that had been made since the debacle of 1870-1871 put on such glorious display at the Expedition Universelle in 1889 were jeopardized by the Dreyfus Affair, which had begun in 1894 with the discovery that someone in the French army was passing secrets to the Germans. Dreyfus, a Jew, was wrongfully accused and convicted. When he was sent to the French penal colony in South America, it seemed a closed matter. But over time, the truth of what had happened came to light. Dreyfus's Jewish background became a source of some of the most poisonous invective France had ever witnessed. The army and its anti-Dreyfusard supporters saw this as a struggle ultimately more significant than one man's guilt or innocence. They saw it as the battle for the soul of France. They believed that Dreyfus and his supporters were undermining France when it was in a vulnerable and dangerous situation, by attacking the army as it stared down the Kaiser and his generals. But the left had one significant advantage going for it in this instance: the truth. In the end, as a result of tireless efforts on behalf of his brother, the novelist Emile Zola, and others, Dreyfus secured his release and eventual reinstatement in the army. But the Dreyfus affair had forced France to decide what it stood for, and in the end, what it stood for was the rights of the individual and the rule of law. One other thing that the Dreyfus affair brought attention to was just how paranoid the French high command was regarding Germany. It was all the Kaiser and his top officials could do not to snicker as France turned itself upside down and inside out. But as the second decade of the new century began, Frenchmen, of whatever political persuasion, had begun to rally around a common national identity. As subsequent events would demonstrate, it proved to be none too soon. Now let's look at two other characters that we're going to see a lot later in the series. For David King and Victor Chapman, Paris meant the pursuit of artistic improvement and accomplishment, as well as personal freedom. Both had been raised in wealthy cocoons, never experiencing physical deprivation or hardship, and they were accustomed to all doors being open to them because of who they were. Both men attended Harvard soon after that university had undergone significant change brought about by University President Charles William Eliot. The university was still largely a preserve of the blue bloods and the wealthy, but the modern university, with its emphasis on research and professional schools, of which Harvard is now the premier example in the popular mind, had its genesis during Eliot's time as president. There's nothing to suggest that either King or Chapman was an especially gifted or promising student at Harvard. In certain respects, like their future brother-in-arms, Kiffin Rockwell at Washington and Lee, they seemed to be in college because it was the usual thing to do for someone of their station at that period in their lives. In fact, both men possessed artistic souls and looked across the Atlantic to Paris, as so many other Americans had done before them. They wanted to find an outlet for artistic expression, one with a notebook and pen and typewriter, the other with a sketch pad, a piece of charcoal, and a box of paints. Considering their social backgrounds, these young men were refreshingly lacking in snobbery and classism. They enjoyed sharing a table, a bottle, and a laugh with anyone who shared their passion for life, and for life in Paris in particular. Diminutive and easygoing, David King didn't write the great American novel or much else during this period, but he did develop a fondness for Pernod and the demi-monde. Victor Chapman was a handsome, gregarious giant with the build of a lumberjack and the generous nature of a child. His youth had been marked by loss, first when his mother died when he was 6 years old, then when his brother drowned in front of him. There's no doubt that his inability to save his brother affected him deeply. For the rest of his life, he never shirked from putting himself at risk to aid others. Children liked him, and so did dogs. On the other hand, his father remarked that there was something about him of silence, mystery, and part of the Middle Ages in his piety. Yet he could eat anything, sleep on anything, lift anything, and endure anything.